The idea that one could go right round the universe and end up where one started makes good science fiction. But it doesn't have much practical significance because it can be shown that the universe would collapse to zero size before one could get round. You'd need to travel faster than light in order to end up where you started before the universe came to an end, and that is not allowed. In the first kind of Friedmann model, which expands and recollapses, space is bent in on itself, like the surface of the Earth. It is therefore finite in extent. In the second kind of model, which expands forever, space is bent the other way, like the surface of a saddle. So in this case, space is infinite. Finally, in the third kind of Friedmann model, with just the critical rate of expansion, space is flat, and therefore is also infinite. But which Friedmann model describes our universe? Will the universe eventually stop expanding and start contracting, or will it expand forever? To answer this question, we need to know the present rate of expansion of the universe and its present average density. If the density is less than a certain critical value, determined by the rate of expansion, the gravitational attraction will be too weak to halt the expansion. If the density is greater than the critical value, gravity will stop the expansion at some time in the future and cause the universe to recollapse. We can determine the present rate of expansion by measuring the velocities at which other galaxies are moving away from us, using the Doppler effect. This can be done very accurately. However, the distances to the galaxies are not very well known because we can only measure them indirectly. So all we know is that the universe is expanding by between 5 and 10% every 1,000 million years. However, our uncertainty about the present average density of the universe is even greater. If we add up the masses of all the stars that we can see in our galaxy and other galaxies, the total is less than 1/100th of the amount required to halt the expansion of the universe, even for the lowest estimate of the rate of expansion. Our galaxy and other galaxies, however, must contain a large amount of dark matter that we cannot see directly, but which we know must be there because of the influence of its gravitational attraction on the orbits of stars and the galaxies. Moreover, most galaxies are found in clusters, and we can similarly infer the presence of yet more dark matter in between the galaxies in these clusters by its effect on the motion of the galaxies. When we add up all this dark matter, we still get only about 1/10th of the amount required to halt the expansion. However, we cannot exclude the possibility that there might be some other form of matter distributed almost uniformly throughout the universe that we have not yet detected, and that might still raise the average density of the universe up to the critical value needed to halt the expansion. The present evidence, therefore, suggests that the universe will probably expand forever, but all we can really be sure of is that even if the universe is going to recollapse, it won't do so for at least another 10,000 million years, since it has already been expanding for at least that long. This shouldn't unduly worry us. By that time, unless we have colonized beyond the solar system, mankind will long since have died out, extinguished along with our sun. All of the Friedmann solutions have the feature that at some time in the past, between 10 and 20,000 million years ago, the distance between neighboring galaxies must have been zero. At that time, which we call the Big Bang, the density of the universe and the curvature of space-time would have been infinite. Because mathematics cannot really handle infinite numbers, this means that the general theory of relativity, on which Friedmann's solutions are based, predicts that there is a point in the universe where the theory itself breaks down. Such a point is an example of what mathematicians call a singularity. In fact, all our theories of science are formulated on the assumption that space-time is smooth and nearly flat. So they break down at the Big Bang singularity, where the curvature of space-time is infinite. This means that even if there were events before the Big Bang, one couldn't use them to determine what would happen afterward because predictability would break down at the Big Bang. Correspondingly, if, as is the case, we know only what has happened since the Big Bang, we could not determine what happened beforehand. As far as we are concerned, events before the Big Bang can have no consequences, so they should not form part of a scientific model of the universe. We should therefore cut them out of the model and say that time had a beginning at the Big Bang. Many people don't like the idea that time has a beginning, probably because it smacks of divine intervention. The Catholic Church, on the other hand, seized on the Big Bang model and in 1951 officially pronounced it to be in accordance with the Bible. There were, therefore, a number of attempts to avoid the conclusion that there had been a Big Bang. The proposal that gained widest support was called the steady-state theory. It was suggested in 1948 by two refugees from Nazi-occupied Austria, Hermann Bondi and Thomas Gold, together with a Briton, Fred Hoyle, who had worked with them on the development of radar during the war. The idea was that as the galaxies moved away from each other, new galaxies were continually forming in the gaps in between from new matter that was being continually created. The universe would therefore look roughly the same at all times, as well as at all points of space. The steady-state theory required a modification of general relativity to allow for the continual creation of matter, but the rate that was involved was so low, about one particle per cubic kilometer per year, that it was not in conflict with experiment. The theory was a good scientific theory in the sense described in Chapter 1. It was simple, and it made definite predictions that could be tested by observation. One of these predictions was that the number of galaxies or similar objects in any given volume of space should be the same wherever and whenever we look in the universe. In the late 1950s and early 60s, a survey of sources of radio waves from outer space was carried out at Cambridge by a group of astronomers led by Martin Ryle, who had also worked with Bondi, Gold, and Hoyle on radar during the war. The Cambridge group showed that most of these radio sources must lie outside our galaxy. Indeed, many of them could be identified with other galaxies, and also that there were many more weak sources than strong ones. They interpreted the weak sources as being the more distant ones, and the stronger ones as being nearer. Then there appeared to be less common sources per unit volume of space for the nearby sources than for the distant ones. This could mean that we are at the center of a great region in the universe in which the sources are fewer than elsewhere. Alternatively, it could mean that the sources were more numerous in the past, at the time that the radio waves left on their journey to us, than they are now. Either explanation contradicted the predictions of the steady-state theory. Moreover, the discovery of the microwave radiation by Penzias and Wilson in 65 also indicated that the universe must have been much denser in the past. The steady-state theory, therefore, had to be abandoned. Another attempt to avoid the conclusion that there must have been a Big Bang, and therefore a beginning of time, was made by two Russian scientists, Evgeny Lifshitz and Isaac Kalitnikov, in 1965. They suggested that the Big Bang might be a peculiarity of Friedman's models alone, which, after all, were only approximations of the real universe. Perhaps of all the models that were roughly like the real universe, only Friedman's would contain a Big Bang singularity. In Friedman's models, the galaxies are all moving directly away from each other, so it is not surprising that at some time in the past, they were all at the same place, in the real universe. However, the galaxies are not just moving directly away from each other. They also have some small sideways velocities. So in reality, they need never have been all at exactly the same place, only very close together. Perhaps then the current expanding universe resulted not from a Big Bang singularity, but from an earlier contracting phase, as the universe had collapsed, the particles in it might not have all collided, but had flown past and then away from each other, producing the present expansion of the universe. How, then, could we tell whether the real universe should have started out with a Big Bang? What Lifshitz and Kalitnikov did was to study models of the universe that were roughly like Friedman's models, but took account of the irregularities and the random velocities of galaxies in the real universe. They showed that such models could start with a Big Bang, even though the galaxies were no longer always moving directly away from each other, but they claimed that this was still only possible in certain exceptional models in which the galaxies were all moving in just the right way. They argued that since there seemed to be infinitely more Friedman-like models without a Big Bang singularity than there were with one, we should conclude that there had not in reality been a Big Bang. They later realized, however, that there was a much more general class of Friedman-like models that did have singularities, in which the galaxies did not have to be moving any special way. They therefore withdrew their claim in 1970. The work of Lifshitz and Kolesnikov was valuable because it showed that the universe could have a singularity, a Big Bang, if the general theory of relativity was correct. However, it did not resolve the crucial question. Does general relativity predict that our universe should have had a Big Bang, a beginning of time? The answer to this came out of a completely different approach introduced by a British mathematician and physicist, Roger Penrose, in 1965. Using the way light cones behave in general relativity together with the fact that gravity is always attractive, he showed that a star collapsing under its own gravity is trapped in a region whose surface eventually shrinks to zero size. And since the surface of the region shrinks to zero, so too must its volume. All the matter in the star will be compressed into a region of zero volume, so the density of matter and the curvature of space-time become infinite. In other words, one has a singularity contained within a region of space-time known as a black hole. At first sight, Penrose's result applied only to stars. It didn't have anything to say about the question of whether the entire universe had a Big Bang singularity in its past. However, at the time that Penrose produced his theorem, I was a research student, desperately looking for a problem with which to complete my PhD thesis. 2 years before I'd been diagnosed as suffering from ALS, commonly known as Lou Gehrig's disease or motor neuron disease, and given to understand that I had only one or two more years to live. In these circumstances, there had not seemed much point in working on my PhD. I didn't expect to survive that long. Yet, 2 years had gone by, and I was not that much worse. In fact, things were going rather well for me, and I'd gotten engaged to a very nice girl, Jane Wilde. But in order to get married, I needed a job, and in order to get a job, I needed a PhD. In 1965, I read about Penrose's theorem that any body undergoing gravitational collapse must eventually form a singularity. I soon realized that if one reversed the direction of time in Penrose's theorem so that the collapse became an expansion, the conditions of his theorem would still hold, provided the universe were roughly like a Friedman model on large scales at the present time. Penrose's theorem had shown that any collapsing star must end in a singularity. The time-reversed argument showed that any Friedman-like expanding universe must have begun with a singularity. For technical reasons, Penrose's theorem required that the universe be infinite in space. So I could, in fact, use it to prove that there should be a singularity only if the universe was expanding fast enough to avoid collapsing again, since only those Friedman models were infinite in space. During the next few years, I developed new mathematical techniques to remove this and other technical conditions from the theorems that proved that singularities must occur. The final result was a joint paper by Penrose and myself in 1970, which at last proved that there must have been a Big Bang singularity, provided only that general relativity is correct and the universe contains as much matter as we observe. There was a lot of opposition to our work, partly from the Russians because of their Marxist belief in scientific determinism, and partly from people who felt that the whole idea of singularities was repugnant and spoiled the beauty of Einstein's theory. However, one cannot really argue with a mathematical theorem. So in the end, our work became generally accepted, and nowadays nearly everyone assumes that the universe started with the Big Bang singularity. It is perhaps ironic that having changed my mind, I am now trying to convince other physicists that there was in fact no singularity at the beginning of the universe. As we shall see later, it can disappear once quantum effects are taken into account. We have seen in this chapter how, in less than half a century, man's view of the universe, formed over millennia, has been transformed. Hubble's discovery that the universe was expanding, and the realization of the insignificance of our own planet in the vastness of the universe, were just the starting point. As experimental and theoretical evidence mounted, it became more and more clear that the universe must have had a beginning in time, until, in 1970, this was finally proved by Penrose and myself on the basis of Einstein's general theory of relativity. That proof showed that general relativity is only an incomplete theory. it cannot tell us how the universe started off, because it predicts that all physical theories, including itself, break down at the beginning of the universe. However, general relativity claims to be only a partial theory. So what the singularity theorems really show is that there must have been a time in the very early universe when the universe was so small that one could no longer ignore the small-scale effects of the other great partial theory of the 20th century, quantum mechanics. At the start of the 1970s, we were forced to turn, then, our search for an understanding of the universe from our theory of the extraordinarily vast to our theory of the extraordinarily tiny. That theory, quantum mechanics, will be described next, before we turn to the efforts to combine the two partial theories into a single quantum theory of gravity. Chapter 4, The Uncertainty Principle. The success of scientific theories, particularly Newton's theory of gravity, led the French scientist, the Marquis de Laplace, at the beginning of the 19th century, to argue that the universe was completely deterministic. Laplace suggested that there should be a set of scientific laws that would allow us to predict everything that would happen in the universe if only we knew the complete state of the universe at one time. For example, if we knew the positions and speeds of the sun and the planets at one time, then we could use Newton's laws to calculate the state of the solar system at any other time. Determinism seems fairly obvious in this case, but Laplace went further to assume that there were similar laws governing everything else, including human behavior. The doctrine of scientific determinism was strongly resisted by many people who felt that it infringed God's freedom to intervene in the world, but it remained the standard assumption of science until the early years of this century. One of the first indications that this belief would have to be abandoned came when calculations by the British scientists Lord Rayleigh and Sir James Jeans suggested that a hot object or body such as a star must radiate energy at an infinite rate. According to the laws we believed at the time, a hot body ought to give off electromagnetic waves, such as radio waves, visible light, or X-rays, equally at all frequencies. For example, a hot body should radiate the same amount of energy in waves with frequencies between 1 and 2 million waves a second, as in waves with frequencies between 2 and 3 million waves a second. Now, since the number of waves a second is unlimited, this would mean that the total energy radiated would be infinite. In order to avoid this obviously ridiculous result, the German scientist Max Planck suggested in 1900 that light, X-rays, and other waves could not be emitted at an arbitrary rate, but only in certain packets that he called quanta. Moreover, each quantum had a certain amount of energy that was greater the higher the frequency of the waves. So, at a higher enough frequency, the emission of a single quantum would require more energy than was available. Thus, the radiation at high frequencies would be reduced, and so the rate at which the body lost energy would be finite. The quantum hypothesis explained the observed rate of emission of radiation from hot bodies very well, but its implications for determinism were not realized until 1926, when another German scientist, Werner Heisenberg, formulated his famous uncertainty principle. In order to predict the future position and velocity of a particle, one has to be able to measure its present position and velocity accurately. The obvious way to do this is to shine light on the particle. Some of the waves of light will be scattered by the particle, and this will indicate its position. However, one will not be able to determine the position of the particle more accurately than the distance between the wave crests of light, so one needs to use light of a short wavelength in order to measure the position of the particle precisely. Now, by Planck's quantum hypothesis, one cannot use an arbitrarily small amount of light. One has to use at least one quantum. This quantum will disturb the particle and change its velocity in a way that cannot be predicted. Moreover, the more accurately one measures the position, the shorter the wavelength of the light that one needs, and hence the higher the energy of a single quantum. So the velocity of the particle will be disturbed by a larger amount. In other words, the more accurately you try to measure the position of the particle, the less accurately you can measure its speed, and vice versa. Heisenberg showed that the uncertainty in the position of the particle times the uncertainty in its velocity times the mass of the particle can never be smaller than a certain quantity, which is known as Planck's constant. Moreover, this limit does not depend on the way in which one tries to measure the position or velocity of the particle, or on the type of particle. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is a fundamental, inescapable property of the world. The uncertainty principle had profound implications for the way in which we view the world. Even after more than 50 years, they've not been fully appreciated by many philosophers, and they are still the subject of much controversy. The uncertainty principle signaled an end to Laplace's dream of a theory of science, a model of the universe that would be completely deterministic. One certainly cannot predict future events exactly if one cannot even measure the present state of the universe precisely. We could still imagine that there is a set of laws that determines events completely for some supernatural being who could observe the present state of the universe without disturbing it. However, such models of the universe are not of much interest to us ordinary mortals. It seems better to employ the principle of economy known as Occam's razor and cut out all the features of the theory that cannot be observed. This approach led Heisenberg, Erwin Schrödinger, and Paul Dirac in the 1920s to reformulate mechanics into a new theory called quantum mechanics, based on the uncertainty principle. In this theory, particles no longer had separate, well-defined positions and velocities that could not be observed. Instead, they had a quantum state, which was a combination of position and velocity. In general, quantum mechanics does not predict a single definite result for an observation. Instead, it predicts a number of different possible outcomes and tells us how likely each of these is. That is to say, if one made the same measurement on a large number of similar systems, each of which started off in the same way, one would find that the result of the measurement would be A in a certain number of cases, B in a different number, and so on. One could predict the approximate number of times that the result would be A or B, but one could not predict the specific result of an individual measurement. Quantum mechanics, therefore, introduces an unavoidable element of unpredictability or randomness into science. Einstein objected to this very strongly, despite the important role he had played in the development of the ideas. Einstein was awarded the Nobel Prize for his contribution to quantum theory. Nevertheless, Einstein never accepted that the universe was governed by chance. His feelings were summed up in his most famous statement, "God does not play dice." Most other scientists, however, were willing to accept quantum mechanics because it agreed perfectly with experiment. Indeed, it has been an outstandingly successful theory and underlies nearly all of modern science and technology. It governs the behavior of transistors and integrated circuits, which are the essential components of electronic devices such as TVs and computers, and is also the basis of modern chemistry and biology. The only areas of physical science into which quantum mechanics has not yet been properly incorporated are gravity and the large-scale structure of the universe. Although light is made up of waves, Planck's quantum hypothesis tells us that in some ways it behaves as if it were composed of particles. It can be emitted or absorbed only in packets or quanta. Equally, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle implies that particles behave in some respects like waves. They do not have a definite position, but they are smeared out with a certain probability distribution. The theory of quantum mechanics is based on an entirely new type of mathematics that no longer describes the real world in terms of particles and waves. It is only the observations of the world that may be described in those terms. There is, thus, a duality between waves and particles in quantum mechanics. For some purposes, it's helpful to think of particles as waves, and for other purposes, it is better to think of waves as particles. An important consequence of this is that one can observe what is called interference between two sets of waves or particles. That is to say, the crests of one set of waves may coincide with the troughs of the other set. The two sets of waves then cancel each other out, rather than adding up to a stronger wave as one might expect. A familiar example of interference in the case of light is the colors that are often seen in soap bubbles. Now, these are caused by reflection of light from the two sides of the thin film of water forming the bubble. White light consists of light waves of all different wavelengths, or colors. For certain wavelengths, the crests of the waves reflected from one side of the soap film coincide with the troughs reflected from the other side. The colors corresponding to these wavelengths are absent from the reflected light, which therefore appears to be colored. Interference can also occur for particles because of the duality introduced by quantum mechanics. A famous example is the so-called two-slit experiment. Consider a partition with two narrow parallel slits in it. On one side of the partition, one places a source of light of a particular color, that is, of a particular wavelength. Most of the light will hit the partition, but a small amount will go through the slits. Now, suppose one places a screen on the far side of the partition from the light. Any point on the screen will receive waves from the two slits. However, in general, the distance the light has to travel from the source to the screen via the two slits will be different. This will mean that the waves from the slits will not be in phase with each other when they arrive at the screen. In some places, the waves will cancel each other out, and in others, they will reinforce each other. The result is a characteristic pattern of light and dark fringes. The remarkable thing is that one gets exactly the same kind of fringes if one replaces the source of light by a source of particles, such as electrons, with a definite speed. This means that the corresponding waves have a definite length. It seems the more peculiar because if one only has one slit, one does not get any fringes, just a uniform distribution of electrons across the screen. One might therefore think that opening another slit would just increase the number of electrons hitting each point of the screen, but because of interference, it actually decreases it in some places. If electrons are sent through the slits, one at a time, one would expect each to pass through one slit or the other, and so behave just as if the slit it passed through were the only one there, giving a uniform distribution on the screen. In reality, however, even when the electrons are sent one at a time, the fringes still appear. Each electron, therefore, must be passing through both slits at the same time. The phenomenon of interference between particles has been crucial to our understanding of the structure of atoms, the basic units of chemistry and biology, and the building blocks out of which we and everything around us are made. At the beginning of this century, it was thought that atoms were rather like the planets orbiting the sun, with electrons, particles of negative electricity, orbiting around a central nucleus, which carried positive electricity. The attraction between the positive and negative electricity was supposed to keep the electrons in their orbits in the same way that the gravitational attraction between the sun and the planets keeps the planets in their orbits. Now, the trouble with this was that the laws of mechanics and electricity, before quantum mechanics, predicted that the electrons would lose energy and so spiral inward until they collided with the nucleus. This would mean that the atom, and indeed all matter, should rapidly collapse to a state of very high density. A partial solution to the problem was found by the Danish scientist Niels Bohr in 1913. He suggested that maybe the electrons were not able to orbit at just any distance from the central nucleus, but only at certain specified distances. If one also supposed that only one or two electrons could orbit at any one of these distances, this would solve the problem of the collapse of the atom, because the electrons could not spiral in any further than to fill up the orbits with the least distances and energies. This model explained quite well the structure of the simplest atom, hydrogen, which was only one electron orbiting around the nucleus, but it was not clear how one ought to extend it to more complicated atoms. Moreover, the idea of a limited set of allowed orbits seemed very arbitrary. the new theory of quantum mechanics resolved the difficulty. It revealed that an electron orbiting around the nucleus could be thought of as a wave, with a wavelength that depended on its velocity. For certain orbits, the length of the orbit would correspond to a whole number, as opposed to a fractional number of wavelengths of the electron. For these orbits, the wave crest would be in the same position each time round, so the waves would add up. These orbits would correspond to Bohr's allowed orbits. However, for orbits whose lengths were not a whole number of wavelengths, each wave crest would eventually be cancelled out by a trough as the electrons went round. These orbits would not be allowed. A nice way of visualizing the wave-particle duality is the so-called sum over histories introduced by the American scientist Richard Feynman. In this approach, the particle is not supposed to have a single history or path in space-time, as it would in a classical non-quantum theory. Instead, it's supposed to go from A to B by every possible path. With each path, there are associated a couple of numbers. One represents the size of a wave, and the other represents the position in the cycle. That is, whether it is at a crest or a trough. The probability of going from A to B is found by adding up the waves for all the paths. In general, if one compares a set of neighboring paths, the phases or positions in the cycle will differ greatly. This means that the waves associated with these paths will almost exactly cancel each other out. However, for some sets of neighboring paths, the phase will not vary much between paths. The waves for these paths will not cancel out, so such paths correspond to Bohr's allowed orbits. With these ideas in concrete mathematical form, it was relatively straightforward to calculate the allowed orbits in more complicated atoms and even in molecules, which are made up of a number of atoms held together by electrons in orbits that go round more than one nucleus. Since the structure of molecules and their reactions with each other underlie all of chemistry and biology, quantum mechanics allows us, in principle, to predict nearly everything we see around us within the limits set by the uncertainty principle. In practice, however, the calculations required for systems containing more than a few electrons are so complicated that we cannot do them. Einstein's general theory of relativity seems to govern the large-scale structure of the universe. It is what is called a classical theory. That is, it does not take account of the uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics as it should for consistency with other theories. The reason that this does not lead to any discrepancy with observation is that all the gravitational fields that we normally experience are very weak. However, the singularity theorems discussed earlier indicate that the gravitational field should get very strong in at least two situations, black holes and the Big Bang. In such strong fields, the effects of quantum mechanics should be important. Thus, in a sense, classical general relativity, by predicting points of infinite density, predicts its own downfall, just as classical, that is, non-quantum mechanics, predicted its downfall by suggesting that atoms should collapse to infinite density. We do not yet have a complete, consistent theory that unifies general relativity and quantum mechanics, but we do know a number of the features it should have. The consequences that these would have for black holes and the Big Bang will be described in later chapters. For the moment, however, we shall turn to the recent attempts to bring together our understanding of the other forces of nature into a single, unified quantum theory. Chapter 5, Elementary Particles and the Forces of Nature. Aristotle believed that all the matter in the universe was made up of four basic elements: earth, air, fire, and water. These elements were acted on by two forces: gravity, the tendency for earth and water to sink, and levity, the tendency for air and fire to rise. This division of the contents of the universe into matter and forces is still used today. Aristotle believed that matter was continuous, that is, one could divide a piece of matter into smaller and smaller bits without any limit. One never came up against a grain of matter that could not be divided further. A few Greeks, however, such as Democritus, held that matter was inherently grainy and that everything was made up of large numbers of various different kinds of atoms. The word atom means indivisible in Greek. For centuries, the argument continued without any real evidence on either side. But in 1803, the British chemist and physicist John Dalton pointed out that the fact that chemical compounds always combined in certain proportions could be explained by the grouping together of atoms to form units called molecules. However, the argument between the two schools of thought was not finally settled in favor of the atomists until the early years of this century. One of the important pieces of physical evidence was provided by Einstein. In a paper written in 1905, a few weeks before the famous paper on special relativity, Einstein pointed out that what was called Brownian relativity, or Brownian motion, the irregular random motion of small particles of dust suspended in a liquid, could be explained as the effect of atoms of the liquid colliding with the dust particles. By this time, there were already suspicions that these atoms were not, after all, indivisible. Several years previously, a fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge, J.J. Thompson, had demonstrated the existence of a particle of matter called the electron that had a mass less than 1/1000th of that of the lightest atom. He used a setup rather like a modern TV picture tube. A red-hot metal filament gave off the electrons, and because these have a negative electric charge, an electric field could be used to accelerate them toward a phosphor-coated screen. When they hit the screen, flashes of light were generated. Soon it was realized that these electrons must be coming from within the atoms themselves. And in 1911, the British physicist Ernest Rutherford finally showed that the atoms of matter do have internal structure. They are made up of an extremely tiny, positively charged nucleus around which a number of electrons orbit. He deduced this by analyzing the way in which particles, which are positively charged, particles given off by radioactive atoms, are deflected when they collide with atoms. At first, it was thought that the nucleus of the atom was made up of electrons and different numbers of a positively charged particle called the proton. That's from the Greek word meaning first, because it was believed to be the fundamental unit from which matter was made. However, in 1932, a colleague of Rutherford's at Cambridge, James Chadwick, discovered that the nucleus contained another particle called the neutron, which had almost the same mass as a proton, but no electrical charge. Chadwick received the Nobel Prize for this discovery and was elected Master of Gonville and Caius College, Cambridge, the college of which I am now a fellow. He later resigned as master because of a disagreement with the fellows. There had been a bitter dispute in the college ever since a group of young fellows returning after the war had voted many of the old fellows out of the college offices that they had held for a long time. This was before my time. I joined the college in 1965 at the tail end of the bitterness, when similar disagreements forced another Nobel Prize-winning master, Sir Neville Mott, to resign. Up to about 20 years ago, it was thought that protons and neutrons were elementary particles, but experiments in which protons were collided with other protons or electrons at high speeds indicated that they were, in fact, made up of smaller particles. These particles were named quarks by the Caltech physicist Murray Gell-Mann, who won the Nobel Prize in 1969 for his work on them. The origin of the name is an enigmatic quotation from James Joyce. Three quarks for Muster Mark. The word quark is supposed to be pronounced like quart, but with a K at the end instead of a T. It is usually pronounced to rhyme with lark. There are a number of different varieties of quarks. There are thought to be at least six flavors, which we'll call up, down, strange, charmed, bottom, and top. Each flavor comes in three colors, red, green, and blue. It should be emphasized that these terms are just labels. Quarks are much smaller than the wavelength of visible light, and so do not have any color in the normal sense. It is just that modern physicists seem to have more imaginative ways of naming new particles and phenomena. They no longer restrict themselves to Greek. A proton, or a neutron, is made up of three quarks, one of each color. A proton contains two up quarks and one down quark. A neutron contains two down and one up. We can create particles made up of other quarks, strange, charmed, bottom and top, but these all have a much greater mass and decay very rapidly into protons and neutrons. We now know that neither the atoms nor the protons and neutrons within them are indivisible. So the question is, what are the truly elementary particles, the basic building blocks from which everything is made. Since the wavelength of light is much larger than the size of an atom, we cannot hope to look at the parts of an atom in the ordinary way. We need to use something with a much smaller wavelength. As we saw in the last chapter, quantum mechanics tells us that all particles are in fact waves, and that the higher the energy of a particle, the smaller the wavelength of the corresponding wave. So the best answer we can give to our question depends on how high a particle energy we have at our disposal, because this determines on how small a length scale we can look. These particle energies are usually measured in units called electron volts. In Thomson's experiments with electrons, we saw that he used an electric field to accelerate the electrons. The energy that an electron gains from an electric field of 1 volt is what is known as an electron volt. In the 19th century, when the only particle energies that people knew how to use were the low energies of a few electron volts generated by chemical reactions such as burning, it was thought that atoms were the smallest unit. In Rutherford's experiment, the particles, had energies of millions of electron volts. More recently, we have learned how to use electromagnetic fields to give particles energies of at first millions and then thousands of millions of electron volts. And so we know that particles that were thought to be elementary 20 years ago are in fact made up of smaller particles. May these, as we go to still higher energies, in turn be found to be made up from still smaller particles? This is certainly possible. But we do have some theoretical reasons for believing that we have, or are very near to, a knowledge of the ultimate building blocks of nature. Using the wave-particle duality discussed in the last chapter, everything in the universe, including light and gravity, can be described in terms of particles. These particles have a property called spin. One way of thinking of spin is to imagine the particles as little tops spinning about an axis. However, this can be misleading because quantum mechanics tells us that the particles do not have any well-defined axis. What the spin of a particle really tells us is what the particle looks like from different directions. A particle of spin zero is like a dot. It looks the same from every direction. On the other hand, a particle of spin one is like an arrow. It looks different from different directions. Only if one turns it around a complete revolution, 360 degrees, does the particle look the same. A particle of spin two is like a double-headed arrow. It looks the same if one turns it round half a revolution, 180 degrees. Similarly, higher spin particles look the same if one turns them through smaller fractions of a complete revolution. All this seems fairly straightforward, but the remarkable fact is that there are particles that do not look the same if one turns them through just one revolution. You have to turn them through two complete revolutions. Such particles are said to have spin one half. All the known particles in the universe can be divided into two groups: particles of spin half, which make up the matter in the universe, and particles of spin 0, 1, and 2, which, we shall see, give rise to forces between the matter particles.